All right, so the Fourth Industrial Revolution, which you can see brilliantly displayed in slide one there. As you can see, the first one was steam, the second electricity, the third computing or digital, and the fourth loosely described as intelligence. And they're saying that this revolution is bigger than electricity and it's bigger than fire, following our Promethean theme. They're saying that the fourth wave is upon us, the smart revolution, and it's going to be a wild ride. Now, the term Fourth Industrial Revolution, which I can't keep saying, I'm going to call it 4IR, sorry, but I'm going to do that. It was first used only quite recently, in 2015, by this guy Klaus Schwab, who was the founder of the World Economic Forum, and he's generally regarded as a capitalist guru. Now, capitalist gurus do tend to come preloaded with investment hype, as they call it. And in fact, he's just written a new book called The Great Reset on how capitalism is supposedly going to reinvent itself after the watershed moment of the COVID pandemic. Okay, slide two, strategic intelligence. Now, you can see from this slide that there are a lot of issues raised by 4IR, almost none of which I'm going to be able to address today, you'll be glad to hear. I'll just show this just to illustrate how wide-ranging the impact of 4IR is likely to be. I couldn't cover all this in 10 talks, or maybe even 50. And not everyone actually agrees with the term 4IR. Some say this is still actually the third industrial revolution, the digital age. But I'm sticking with Klaus Schwab because it just sounds cooler and sexier. 3IR was the human brain in a digital office, if you like. And 4IR is the machine brain. And there's also a distinction I should make between the fourth industrial revolution, which includes wider society, and Industry 4.0, which is just about industry. But there's quite a lot of overlap, so I might not be that consistent. Okay, so what is the smart revolution? Slide three, an office desk. Well, 3IR revolutionized the human desktop, or in other words, everything you'd find on or near a desk. So typewriter, calculator, phone, letter, paper, stamps, file and cabinet, address book, even the executive toys. 3IR was an office or a back office revolution. And it created big changes in business practice, but wider society took a while to catch up. People didn't see a use for computers at first. When I had one in the 1980s, nobody else saw the point of them, it seemed. Gradually, society latched on, and we got the World Wide Web, YouTube, catch-up TV, smartphones, social media, etc. But it was a revolution in human communications. The way things were marketed and sold changed, but the way they were manufactured stayed the same as it always had. 3IR never really left the office for the shop floor. Slide four is a shop floor. Well, this was not for want of trying, but early attempts in the 1980s, things like computer integrated manufacturing, never really got off the ground. There were too many problems with non-standard components, different suppliers organized in different ways, different data standards, etc. Capitalism just wasn't geared up for full computerization. So the big beasts of production, the factories, remain largely deaf, dumb and stupid. But now these big beasts are starting to talk and using the same language, using the rudiments of what you could call intelligence. This is the digital revolution of operational technology, OT. OT meets IT. OT is the IT for the uncarpeted areas of production, the heavy machinery of the smart factory. Okay, slide five, smart factory. In the last few years, what's called a constellation of technologies have been developing, which taken together can be reasonably described, I think, as a revolution. And constellation is a good word because the potential is quite dazzling. So what are the technologies? So let's go through a few key ones. Slide six, we've got sensors, the smart sensor, cheap, robust, mass-produced sensors that can measure something and then transmit data about it. So for a trivial example, tyre manufacturers are now putting sensors inside tyres which tell the car's central computer if the tyres are correctly inflated for the actual driving conditions and send the driver a warning if not. Cars are a good example in other ways. They're becoming packed full of sensors that monitor driving lane, speed of vehicle in front, air temperature, moisture on the window, objects in the blind spots. Sensors can be used for anything it's possible to measure, so they can be put in any factory component, process, or moving part. This enables the construction of a virtual or digital twin, which shows you every part of the factory as a dynamic moving whole, and can report not just when a component has worn out, but when it is going to wear out, in turn enabling preemptive maintenance and thus avoiding expensive downtime. You can imagine the same thing operating for your house. Smart ovens that turn themselves off when they realise your bread's going to get burnt, etc. Smart fridges that order for you. In the future, with nanotechnology, you could even imagine the same thing for your body. Nanotechnology, I would say, is next gen. That's the fifth industrial revolution. Anyway, moving on. Slide 7, Internet of Things. Now you'll have heard of this. This is 5G, IoT or IIoT, the Industrial Internet of Things. Okay, so you're all familiar with email addresses. You can all talk to each other. Now every object, every component, every sensor in the world can have its own address, so everything can talk to everything. This is the Internet of Things. 5G is a gigantic expansion of addressable capacity and bandwidth to enable all this. To give you some idea, at present, if you've got a decent internet connection, you'll probably be getting a 1 or 2 megabit download speed. That's 2 million bits per second. With 5G, that should look more like 1 to 10 gigabits. That's 1,000 million bits per second or 10,000 million bits per second. Okay, slide 8, cloud computing. Bit of a silly picture, I agree. This is two parts of this. Big data, I'm conflating big data and cloud computing. It's said that every industrial revolution makes use of a cheap resource. Stone Age used stone, and then industrial revolution used iron, followed by coal, then transistors. Now, data is the cheap resource, and the ability to acquire it and the ability to analyze it is key to the 4IR. Big data means spotting trends or patterns a human would miss. And the cloud, sitting in the middle there, makes this data processing cheap because you don't have to use your own giant server farm. And it's crucial because it connects all the other technologies, like the hub in the middle of a wheel. Slide 9, virtual reality. Okay. VR's got a bit of an image of unwashed nerds fighting fantasy battles, but just yesterday there was a report in the BBC about a new virtual reality house hunting app that you can use. It's getting quite popular at the moment because of the pandemic, so you can go around somebody's house virtually. VR is the ultimate tool for doing anything manual at a distance, whether it's flying a drone, picking through rubble in an earthquake area, controlling a piece of industrial machinery, or performing a surgical operation from a different continent. It's potentially an amazing design and teaching tool as well, so you can learn to build a bridge or learn to fly a plane in an immersive and realistic environment, but without the real-world failure consequences. Slide 10, the robot team, robotics. Think of a car manufacturer, and you already know all about robotics. It means you can reduce costs in factory floor space. The spacing in factory floors is mainly because of the human requirements. You can reduce lighting, heating, health and safety, and obviously wages. But there are limitations because a robot only does what it's built to do. So retasking a robot is quite difficult and often not an option. Interesting, in the last few years, in order to retool for the electric car quasi-revolution, Toyota has been replacing robots with humans because humans are more adaptive, and that's just what they need right now. Okay, 11, additive manufacturing, also known as 3D printing. I first wrote about this when 3D printers were a prototyping tool. I thought they were new, but in fact they've been around since the 1980s principle. Back in 2005, all they could do was print a plastic shape like a chess piece. But as we heard earlier, now they can print pieces of buildings, so you can basically put together prefab houses out of them. They can also print electrical circuits, unmanned aerial vehicles, and just lately I read they can print heavy steel armour plate for repairing battlefield vehicles right in the field without involving a long wait and a lengthy and vulnerable supply chain. Some people say that we'll soon see fully functioning robots walking right out of the printer delivery bin. I'd quite like to see 3D printers that produce roast dinners out of waste recycled feedstock. That's a point you can take up, because I don't think capitalism is ever going to invent something that will undermine its own scarcity, reinforce prices. You'll have to wait for socialism for that. Slide 12, biotech. Okay, so this is production with the aid of living organisms, and we've always had this. Think of yeast in bread or beer, or dairy produce. Today, biotech's such a big field that it's broken down by colours. So you've got blue biotech for marine resources and minerals, green for agriculture, red for pharmaceuticals and medical, white for industrial, yellow for food and fermentation, and there's even a dark one for bioweapons. There's a gold one too for bioinformatics. That's a bit of horizontal technology involving DNA computing, a kind of organic relative of quantum parallel computing. Very next-gen stuff. Next one, artificial intelligence. That's a picture of Terminator I just put in for fun. But the image that AI would really like to represent is the following one, slide 13b, the little friendly chipmunks there. That's how capitalism wants you to see AI. AI, which includes machine learning, voice and face recognition. So you already know AI when automated phone systems give you options, when Amazon tells you what it thinks you want, or YouTube tells you what it thinks you want to watch next. They're all using AI. Now, there's been probably more hype and hysteria about AI than anything else. So this is a good point to introduce a note of scepticism into all this, to talk about something called the hype cycle. This is where an overproduction of optimism in a technology, any technology, leads to a slump and a depression when progress stalls before it rebounds with renewed optimism with a new breakthrough. It's a bit like kangarooing on the motorway. It's all rush, rush, rush 1 minute and then stop, stop, stop the next minute. There have been at least three AI winters so far, from the 1950s onwards, and a lot of pundits are expecting another AI winter quite soon. So if you read that AI is defunct and bust, you'll be seeing the results of media snow in an AI winter. Yet another one. Okay, slide 14. Neural computer. We've heard this mentioned this weekend. The idea of AI is to get a machine to think like a human brain. Why? Because it won't get tired, forget, go on strike or die. The problem with this is nobody actually knows how the human brain works. Despite building these neural networks that supposedly mimic the brain's wiring. And not only that, nobody can figure out how the brain does what it does on such low power. A neural computer uses around 15,000 watts, and a brain uses 20 watts. No one can figure out how. They're throwing the kitchen sink at AI, but computational power is also hitting space and heat limits. You've probably got a dual-core or a quad-core computer at home. Now, there are 400,000 core chips. Moore's famous law of perpetually doubling capacity, though, is starting to break down and hit its absolute limits. But it's still not enough to get good neural computers. Moving on, the next one, slide customer services. Bored-looking customer service person there. So the word intelligence is what gets people terrified of a Terminator apocalypse. but it's a bit misleading. Artificial intelligence isn't intelligence. It's basically sophisticated pattern recognition, which means it's really useful in some ways and really extremely limited in others, because it has no concept of what any human child would call common sense. So it's good within well-defined and limited parameters, but real life very rarely looks like that. Real life is messy and not tidy at all, just like humans. This leads to something called Moravec's paradox, where hard things are easy for AI and easy things are hard. So, for example, it's fairly easy to create a world-beating AI Go champion, but it's nearly impossible to create an average bored customer services representative. Add to this the present state of big data to feed it with. Data is patchy, it's inconsistent, it's hard to string together coherently. Data wrangling is thought to take up 80% of the effort in any AI project. And the expertise is hard to get and expensive. Many firms can't afford the exotic salaries that AI experts can demand. And there's no guarantee AI will deliver the benefits claimed. If you think about self-driving cars, which still aren't fully autonomous, and to be quite frank, may never be, because no AI has the common sense needed for unexpected road conditions. If you put a sticker over part of a road sign, and your car will not recognise the road sign, or you throw a bit of snow on the road and your car won't recognise lane markings all of a sudden, and you're crashed in a ditch as a result. Humans are a complete mystery to AI, and AI is a mystery to humans. As we've already heard from Leon, AI is a black box you can't see inside. It can give you a result, but you don't know what its reasoning was, so you don't know if it's the right result. Ask the AI to explain the result and you've got into a recursive loop, because you don't know if you can trust the explanation. Boeing recently killed 2 plane loads of people because it didn't understand how its own AI worked. Going back to 2012, Knight Capital, a trading firm, watched its AI lose $10 million a minute for 44 minutes straight because employees didn't understand what it was doing or how to stop it. In a medical example, a cancer prediction study had to be junked when it was found that the AI was predicting cancers based not on the patient scans, but on the edge markings of the scans that told it which hospital the scan came, and then making predictions on the basis of relative hospital cancer rates. We would call that cheating, but the AI regarded that as a perfectly valid way to make a prediction. Okay, slide 16. We've got AI racism. You'll have read some of these stories about this probably. These are the hidden assumptions where the AI picks up unconscious human biases and runs with them. Hewlett-Packard had to junk its AI recruitment tool because it was only choosing middle-class white males. That's because the CVs it had been trained on were mostly from middle-class white males, so it just associated success with that group. A Justice Department AI did a similar thing so that white suspects got probation and black ones didn't. As an old computer saying has it, garbage in, garbage out. So for all these reasons, my guess is that AI will be one of those technologies that will forever be almost but not quite. Not quite good enough for autonomous cars or planes. Not quite good enough for so-called lights-out factories. Not good enough to completely take humans out of the loop. Slide 17 is a lights-out factory. So where is 4IR at the moment? It's at an early stage. Some technologies like robotics and 3D printing are relatively old and mature. Others are still emerging. What's holding back things back mostly is the nature of capitalism itself. Competition over industrial and legal standards, a lack of integrated international government policy, and the ongoing fight between proprietary and open source software. Then there's industrial secrecy with patent wars and huge amounts of duplication, parallel development and wasted effort. Also, the cost of retooling is shutting out all but the biggest companies, so development is uneven within and between countries. On top of all that, there's the question of who owns the tech and who owns the data. The US-Huawei dispute is old news now, but now Trump's war against TikTok, Tencent and all things Chinese threatens to balkanize global communications into a splinter net, following the lead of Russia under Putin and, of course, China itself with its great firewall. Then, of course, there's the question of how many people still don't have basic internet access, i.e. the third industrial revolution hasn't really impacted on them yet. The next slide, slide 18, you can see from these very recent internet statistics from this year, in the part I've circled, you can see the ratio, the penetration rates for Africa, 42%, Asia still 58%. More advanced capitalist countries are higher, but still, even in North America, there's a digital divide of 10% of the population. Okay, so where's it all going? Assuming the current trajectory doesn't get derailed by all these disputes I just mentioned, what does the future look like? Well, for capitalists, it's all about a massive increase in productivity, along with a huge reduction in costs. Subjectively, though, how will it look from the standpoint of someone in an advanced capitalist country? Okay, so slide 19. This is an Amazon Go store. The first one is just opening up in London. If you're a customer with money, capitalism is going to be your Shangri-La. You'll see more cashless processes appearing, like unstaffed 24/7 shops that unlock when they see you and let you walk out with goods without paying. They identify you by face recognition and bill your account directly. Or you won't have to shop at all because your smart kitchen will reorder for you. You'll see drone and robot deliveries and front doors with key code access hatches for when you're not in. This is the end of the one-size-fits-all mass production revolution of 3IR, so you'll see 3D print-on-demand and smart factories that let you personalise your purchase from hundreds of customisable permutations. Okay, slide 20, the smart city. Cities are going to become quieter and cleaner with smart traffic lighting to regulate traffic flow. All electric transport and expanded park and ride and car sharing schemes. You'll tend to buy large expensive items less and rent more. For example, cars. The current software trend towards subscription services could develop into a convergence of the current platform companies like Uber, Just Eat, Airbnb, B&B, towards a super platform subscription service where you pay in your monthly salary and then everything is free. A bit like pretend socialism. For the consumer, nothing is too much trouble. Capitalism wants to make your life easy, which of course is a contradiction, as nearly all consumers are also workers. And from the workers' point of view, it could scarcely be more different. Slide 21, hamster on wheels. It's quite the opposite for the worker. You could be working harder, faster, smarter, and longer than ever. The COVID crisis has accelerated a growing trend towards home working, as we've seen. But workers are overly optimistic if they think this is good news for them. So far, employers have ignored the possibilities of home working because they aren't always the brightest people, quite frankly, and have an old-fashioned preference for having their workers where they can see them, even though they're fully aware of the presenteeism problem, where workers, like I always try to do, turn up dutifully every day and do as little as possible. Well, COVID could change all that as employers latch onto the real advantages. They can make enormous savings in premises costs, heating bills, office equipment, all of that the workers will have to supply them for themselves, as I think Bill pointed out in his talk. They can pay piece rate instead of hourly, which means workers just can't skive off. Health and safety rules and rules about maximum hours can be thrown out of the window. And they get the pick of a global labour market, which will drive down wages to a global minimum. So workers will be like the proverbial hamsters on a wheel, constantly managing multiple piece rate jobs at derisory rates of pay in an online global gig economy and with no ability to unionise. They'll suffer health problems through poverty, isolation, lack of exercise, and relentless deadline stress. And much of this we're actually already seeing, but it'll just get worse. And that's not all. Most of what today's school children are learning in school is already irrelevant or will soon become so. According to the World Economic Forum, 65% of the jobs that today's primary school children will eventually apply for don't exist yet. Training is not going to be enough because job roles will keep changing. So perpetual on-the-job retraining is likely to be a permanent feature of work. So if you're a worker, you're going to have to retrain, definitely at your own expense, just to keep in work. You'll be constantly running to stand still, having to learn more and more in order to do less and less. There's also likely to be a squeezing of the middle for the working class, with some people being squeezed upwards towards the high-level technical jobs that 4IR needs, while middling jobs disappear as workers are employed to train and refine machine learning algorithms that steadily eat away at their skill bases. Meanwhile, the education barrier to employment will rise, meaning that many are squeezed downward towards low-paid service jobs that machines either can't do or would be too expensive for, jobs like care work, hairdressing, and massage. I can even imagine the return of domestic service and perhaps universities for butlers and chambermaids. Under the employability bar, underneath that, there will be, of course, the dark underbelly that we already have, featuring cashless, black market, barter, crime, drugs and prostitution. So what about the long term? One aspect of 4IR is the conquest of distance, so it doesn't matter where you live. A flight to the country is likely for those who can afford it. In fact, we're seeing it already. Here's the next slide, slide 21A, I just inserted yesterday, is a story from the BBC just the other day about people moving to the country. City dwellers seek out country life. That's for those who can afford it. For those who can't afford it, I foresee a rise of workers' dormitory cities. That's the next slide, tower blocks. These will be disease sinks, poverty sinks, high-rise estates with high crime, high mortality, and drug addiction. Slide 23, wealth gap. A second aspect of 4IR is that a massive rise in productivity and reduction of costs and wastage won't trickle down as more general wealth. It won't float all boats. It will percolate upwards. The rich-poor divide, which is huge already, is likely to become unimaginably vast. And the elite few will get fewer as the big swallow the little. The remaining power blocks will face each other in a showdown for global dominance. The use of AI and VR weapons could make the Third World War fairly short and final, even if it doesn't go nuclear. Well, all of that is a worst-case scenario, of course. What we do know is that clever tools don't make a clever user, and smart technology doesn't make for smart capitalism. It's possible that a properly integrated global economy would be able to stop the boom and slump cycle by adjusting production to demand instantly and thus avoiding crises of overproduction. But this presupposes a central control system with access to all industry and commercial data, which further presupposes a global governing body. For this to happen, globally competing transnational companies and states would have to cooperate and cede all power to such a body, and I just, for one, can't see that ever happening. What's more likely is environmental collapse. For all the smart tech and the upbeat talk about green business and circular economies, the trajectory of capitalism, I think, is still towards a global tragedy of the commons, so that the human race could ultimately go the way of the dinosaurs. Now, slide 24. In socialism, every productive advance that capitalism makes is a gigantic gift to the people of socialism, if they want it. Customised production, smart automation, remote working, VR, digital twins, all of this could fabulously enhance socialism's productive power beyond anything Marx or our founders really could imagine. And Leon gave some hint of that in his talk this morning. But it's also possible, being a little bit sceptical, that a lot of capitalism's tech toys would be thrown away in favour of the KISS principle. KISS being keep it simple, stupid. Socialism doesn't need and wouldn't want, and for reasons I've already hinted at, probably couldn't have fully automated luxury. Why? Well, because we don't want too much. We only want enough. We don't want complete idleness because we like doing things with our hands and our brains. And we like simplicity because we know that the more complex a system is, the more ways there are for it to break down and the harder it is to fix. Capitalism is obsessed with novel gadgets and complexity, but this involves adding more and more failure points. In a good design, you aim to reduce failure points to the bare minimum. And nor would citizens of a globally commonly owned society want to surrender all their control and decision-making to machines, even supposing there was no shadowy technocracy behind the machines, which is one problem that people had with the Zeitgeist technocratic model. Why? Well, because we're humans and we like to argue and we like to work out our problems for ourselves and take responsibility like grown adults, not pampered babies. Slide 25. One guess I would like to venture is the decline of cities. At present, the world is urbanizing into giant megacities. Global megacities are global mega disease sinks and require global mega agriculture to maintain, which is burning up the world's arable land. I suggest socialist society would reverse the trend. When you look at the historical reasons for urbanisation, they're almost all to do with better job opportunities in property society. There's nothing, therefore, natural about living in cities. If the anthropologist Robin Dunbar is right, we're genetically evolved to only know 150 people maximum, which is a village, not a city. Villages tend to promote community bonding, communication, and egalitarian cooperative behaviour. Cities are property constructs which promote alienation, anonymity, and remote hierarchical control. Plus, as I've hinted, cities are the main vector for pandemics. The more dispersed we are, and the more dispersed our working practices are, the better our overall survival chances. I don't say that cities will disappear entirely, just that they will shrink and lose their significance. What happens today, cities are organic things with inputs and outputs. Young people who are born in the suburbs or hinterland flock into city centres, staying in communal digs for purposes of work or study and social life and culture and sex, etc., etc., but gradually move out to the suburbs as they pair off and settle down to a quieter life. That's if they can afford to. But they're still trapped in the city's gravitational orbit because they need to find paid work. They might want to escape further, but they just can't. Slide 26, the global village. Socialism, I would argue, together with the remote working tools of 4IR, will break the gravitational attraction of cities once and for all. The more people who can leave the city, the more will leave. And the further they can go, the further they will go. The exodus will intensify and expand its wavefront in every direction that allows travel. It won't stop at county or country borders, although it may be constricted and channeled by natural features like deserts, mountains, oceans and so forth, and other regions with no road or infrastructure network. If taken together with its suburbs and expanding hinterland, a city will become larger but less dense until it overlaps with other cities in a continental or even a global mass Venn diagram. It essentially becomes a distributed network. The city shrinks as towns and villages grow, and they become roughly proportional and equidistant nodes in this network. As the city expands into the country will therefore also make inroads into the city in an interpenetration of opposites. The need for and the space for large-scale mechanised farming will be diminished, gradually being displaced and replaced by localised production through small holdings, vertical farming, hydroponics, green housing, forest gardening, rooftop allotments, biotech, etc. Next slide is vertical farming. It's easy to see how this process could be managed communally, with all local efforts being coordinated locally, along with customised regional mass production. That means the regional and global transference of material and finished goods can be minimised. The only things that may need to travel across the world are certain raw materials and you. Next slide, flying jet. New lightweight carbon fibre alloys and new fuels could make air travel clean and sustainable. Instead of a ponderous and sedentary ape species caged in its little flagged country hutches, human society could become an ever-shifting and dynamic swirl of global interaction and colour and cultural cross-pollination. While the older people might prefer to take life slow in settled communities, they can be the ones learning to be good at science or music or beer brewing or whatever, the young would have the option of being off, having the time of their lives, living in the jet stream, so to speak, seeing everything the world has to offer and helping out with the menial work wherever they land. So in conclusion, you'll be glad to hear, the thing about technology, whether it's good or bad, depends on what you use it for, as has been said to this weekend already. Final slide. To echo this week's Promethean theme again, in capitalism, science and technology are too often like fire in the hands of arsonists. But if we can persuade the world to take its technology and do something really constructive with it, I think there's no limit to what we could achieve. And that's the end of my talk.